Thank you very much for coming out this morning for another in our series on medical ethics, medical halacha. This one is, I suppose, a hybrid. The specific topic of medical care for terrorists. I'll ask people once again to make sure that you sign in so that you can get the credit as well as feedback and follow-up after the class. If you have a cell phone, if you could please either silence it, put it on vibrate, whatever your preferred method, that would be wonderful. I want to begin by noting what we are not discussing this morning. Number one topic that we are not discussing is the overall issue of Israel and the Arabs. To a certain extent, it's going to fit into this anyway, because you can't not discuss it. It has bearing on the specifics of the case. At the same time, don't look for conservative, liberal, left, right, whatever in this discussion. We're going to try to stick to what the sources tell us about a case as though it were in a vacuum, to the extent that one actually can do that. That's number one. Number two, what we're not going to be dealing with is the case of Elor Azaria. The verdict for manslaughter a week and a half ago, while it's a fascinating case in its own right, it's actually a separate issue. That's the question of use of lethal force on an apparently subdued terrorist. And I actually gave classes on that a couple of years ago. I gave you a link at the top of the page if you're on the email list already, you received this by email in advance. You can just click on it. Otherwise, you can retype it from here. But that's a recording of a class I gave on the topic of using lethal force on an apparently subdued terrorist. So that's really its own discussion. What we're here to discuss is a different issue. I suppose it's associated, but it's the issue of whether to treat the terrorist, or apparent terrorist, I should say, at the scene. If you take a look at source number one, you see why this is a question, right? One might wonder, like, why am I even thinking about this? Why am I thinking about potentially treating him? Well, take a look at source number one. This is an article from the Times of Israel, December of 2015, and it was a very hot issue in the media for quite a while. It still services from time to time. Medics at terror sites must treat the wounded according to the severity of their injuries, even if that means helping an attacker before his victims, the Israeli Medical Association said in rules published this week. Right? In other words, you treat people based on severity of injury, you do standard triage, and the identity of the victim, or the identity of the injured party, I should say, doesn't matter. So if the terrorist blowing himself up actually has a worse injury, for some reason, than somebody else, you would actually treat the terrorist first, according to the Israel Medical Association. The new rules formulated by the IMA's Ethics Bureau came into effect at the beginning of the week and replaced an earlier directive based on the principle of charity begins at home, which enabled medical professionals to treat victims first. The Hebrew language Israel Hayom newspaper reported Wednesday. That was the decision in December of 2015. Well, Zaka, which is not governed by the Israeli Medical Association, it's a separate organization, said absolutely not. Source number two. From the same writer in the Times of Israel, in a statement, Zaka chairman and founder Yehuda Meshi Zahav made it clear that the organization's medics would turn their attention to the victims first, regardless of the injuries sustained by their attacker. And then in the third piece that I brought you here, this is a piece that appeared in Lancet, Treating Terrorists and Victims, and if you look at the names of the writers, one name in particular will stand out, and that is the name of Rabbi Dr. Abraham Steinberg. They compare dealing with the terrorist and taking care of the terrorist with what happened in the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing. After treating the Boston Marathon suspected terrorist, the head of emergency medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center admitted, quote, some staff battled second thoughts and anxiety over saving the life of a suspected terrorist. This has also been our experience. It is easy to take to the moral high ground when an issue is purely theoretical. Quite another matter when shock, frustration, and anger enter into play. In other words, it's well and good for an academic or somebody sitting in an office somewhere to tell me that I have to treat the terrorist. It's another thing when I'm actually witnessing what this person has done and all the damage to all of the lives of people who are dead and bleeding and maimed and so on. You're telling me that I have to actually treat The Boston example emphasizes the need for unambiguous guidance and a crystal clear message to caregivers confronted with these stressful and emotional circumstances. Now, had you stopped reading the article there, you might be inclined to think he's going to say don't treat, because he describes the emotional impact. But take a look at what he does in the next paragraph. And obviously this is an excerpt from a longer piece. You can find it online. If you grab any of the phrases that are here within the article and you just Google them, you'll find the full article. But they write, in our opinion, all patients entering the hospital are unequivocally equal without exception. As difficult as it might be, the medical staff must not be judgmental. Punishment is not the role of the medical staff. Rather, their duty and obligation is to preserve life and restore health. Judgment should be the exclusive providence of the legal system, and physicians should practice their art without discrimination and with a clear conscience. And in case anyone is not familiar with Avram Steinberg, he is, on the one hand, I think he's a pediatric neurosurgeon, and then pediatric neurologist, and on the other hand, a leading, like globally leading expert on medical halacha and medical ethics from the perspective of Jewish law. So this is somebody who, when he says something, is not to be trifled with and simply dismissed. His argument is, as part of this article written with Ofer Merin and Sarah Goldberg, I would give you their bios as well, but I must admit I don't know. But his argument is that, in fact, one ought to treat. Now, while it would be interesting to poll the room about what you feel doctors ought to do at the scene or in the hospital thereafter, I want to be able to speak for the next hour and a quarter about the topic at hand. And I have a feeling that I'd have about 5 minutes left after we were done polling everybody. So I'm going to skip that. The way I want to deal with this is from a series of different perspectives. But actually before that, one point that I want to make is probably best made by a person who is involved in an actual case of the issue of treating a terrorist at the scene of the attack. Take a look at source number 4, please. This is from a nice piece in Sunnybrook Magazine about a doctor who was there. I don't think she's still there. I think she went back to Israel. Dr. Gabi Elbaz, or Elbaz Greener as her name is in the title, she's a cardiologist, as you see. Dr. Gabi Elbaz Greener is nothing if not determined. It's a trait that may have saved her life once, and it's served her well ever since. 20 years ago, she was taking a bus to school in Jerusalem, where she was studying to be an occupational therapist. Her life changed forever that day when a suicide bomber blew himself up aboard the bus. Lying on the ground, bleeding profusely with 2 severed arteries, she remembers thinking that she didn't want to die alone. I wanted an hour to say goodbye to my family. I was begging with my eyes for someone to save my life, remembers Dr. Elbaz Greener. A man took me from the bus and put his t-shirt around my neck. He told me after, looking at your eyes, I couldn't leave you. The surgeon who performed 10 hours of surgery to save her life told her he was surprised she survived. Now, in and of itself, you read this and say, well, it's an interesting story, but why is Torchino bringing it? I gave this class a version of this. It was a shorter version of this class at Shari Shemayim a year ago, and Dr. Elbaz was there. And she spoke beforehand and filled in a piece which you don't see in Sunnybrook Magazine. Anyone here familiar with her story? Okay, so a few people know what's coming. Dr. Elbaz was indeed on this bus. The bomber had actually initially sat down beside her and then moved to the back of the bus. And lest anyone think that he moved to the back of the bus because he wanted to spare her, it was because there was another bus behind them and he wanted to maximize the damage by getting both. But as she tells the story, when she regained consciousness after the surgery, they told her that during this 10-hour surgery, someone came into the operating room and told them that she was the bomber. She was suspected of being the terrorist. And as she describes it, they paused, like the people in the room paused, and then they went back to work and, you know, continued this 10-hour surgery to save her life. One of the pieces to all of this, this whole discussion, has to be not the medical ethics decision of, is it right for me to make this decision? But do I have enough information to make this decision? You're a doctor at the scene of an attack or the immediate aftermath. How much do you not know about what actually happened? You can make a decision, as, you know, would have been the case here, to end the life of an innocent person. So, yeah, while we're talking about this as though we're talking about, you know, doctors who know who did it, remember, you may not know who did it. And that adds a whole frightening layer to the entire conversation. So the way I want to tackle this is from multiple perspectives. Five different Torah-based, halacha-based roles, presenting each one siloed as an independent perspective. This doesn't work in practice. In other words, the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to lay out what a medical halachic perspective should be, what a military halachic perspective should be, what the perspective of a judge in a rabbinical court would be, the perspective of a politician, and the perspective of a general humanitarian. Not because you can actually do that, meaning the person who's on the scene who needs to make the decision has to take all of these considerations into perspective. Someone who's setting policy has to take into consideration all of them. But I find that if you try to do it all at once, it's just a blob. So what I want to do is isolate the different factors that we're talking about into five different units that I think make it easier to follow what ultimately halacha is going to determine. So we start with a medical perspective, and ask, from a doctor's perspective, what would be the, in other words, forgetting diplomatic concerns of what will the nation say if we let him die or treat him or whatever, forgetting the military perspective of, you know, if I let him go, or worse, if I treat him and make him better, he's now going to blow up other people. Leaving that factor aside, you're a doctor on the scene, and a doctor has a mandate to heal. We've discussed that on other occasions. Does your mandate to heal, does your biblical obligation of healing other people pertain to somebody who just blew himself up trying to kill our brethren? That's the simple and straightforward opening question. What would you say? Okay, Vashevoso Lo says that in the event that somebody loses property, and we extend that not just from property, but also to a person's health, I have an obligation to restore it to him. So you're saying that the medical obligation, or the medical halachic obligation to heal, will apply even to this person who was hurt trying to hurt others. Okay. Anyone want to bring me a source that says otherwise? Besides from my source sheets. He's a Rodef. So Rodef is an interesting argument. The argument of Rodef means this person is a pursuer. He's trying to kill other people. And that's going to be an argument we're going to have to deal with when we get to the judicial perspective, to the judge's perspective. Because again, I'm trying to isolate the different factors, and that's really a judicial question rather than a medical question.
But he's not a Rodef, he's a Ratzeach.
So when we get to the judicial perspective, we're going to have to ask the question of, is he called a pursuer when he has, at least for the moment, done pursuing? We don't know what he's going to do tomorrow, but would he, at least as of now, what he has done has been to, is done, and now he's not a rodent, now he's a murderer, maybe. So let's take it from a medical perspective first. The doctor's duty to heal is clear cut. In source number one, I brought you the source number five. Sorry, I brought you the Gemara in Bava Kamma. We're familiar, but we've discussed it before, where the Talmud states that a doctor has permission to heal. We've discussed why the Torah needs to permit someone to heal. If there's already a biblical obligation not to stand by while somebody's blood is being shed, why do I need a permission to heal? One explanation is, lest somebody say, well, it's God's will that this person be hurt and suffer, and therefore who am I to contravene it? That's one approach. Another approach is, lest you be concerned that in trying to heal somebody you might make things worse. There are always side effects. A doctor can make mistakes. Nonetheless, the Torah says, there is such a thing as a doctor, and you are supposed to heal people. That's permission to heal. We have obligations to heal beyond the permission. One of them is what Dr. Kirshen had mentioned about Vahashev Osolo, returning a person's life and health to him. Another one is the one I just mentioned, Lo Samod Al Dam Rayacha, don't stand by while somebody's blood is shed. Another one, Vahavta L'Rayacha Kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. And lest anyone ask the question, because the question is always asked, does this obligation to heal apply to non-Jews as well? Right? We're dealing with a non-Jewish terrorist. The answer is yes, your obligation to heal, not necessarily from all of the verses that we cited, but from some of them, will apply to non-Jews as well. So, V'rachamav al-kol ma'asav, the idea that Hashem's mercy is on all of His creations, is brought in the Rambam in Maimonides in source number 6 to speak about the obligation that we have to others who are not Jewish as well. if you're dealing with a ger toshav, with somebody who observes the seven Noahide laws, I might note that one of them is don't kill. So, you know, the terrorist isn't necessarily a candidate for ger toshav status. It's worth being aware that for the ger toshav, there absolutely is a mitzvah l'hachayoso to restore him to life, as I brought you from the Rambam in source number 7. So there is a duty of healing people. However, the key question you have to ask here, before we get into what a judge would say about somebody who is a rodei for a rotseach, either one, a pursuer or a murderer, before we even get there, you have the following question. The fellow on the bus blew himself up. We call him a suicide bomber for a reason, right? He was taking his own life. Do I have a medical obligation to save the life of somebody who tried knowingly, with full knowledge? I'm not now dealing with somebody who is suicidally depressed. I'm not dealing with somebody for whom we would say they didn't know what they were doing at the time. They were under intense emotional pressure. That's not what I'm talking about. This is a different kind of insane that we're dealing with. If somebody makes the decision to take his own life, do I have any obligation to try to restore him to health? Finish it for him. He wanted to do this. Let him go his own way. So there is indeed a view that suggests that you're not obligated. Not even in this, again, in this dramatic case, but in general, if a person attempts to commit suicide, you have no obligation to stop him, so to speak, from that. Again, assuming it's somebody who is in their right mind, in the sense that we're not talking about somebody who is emotionally distressed and incapable of making a decision. If you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Yosef Babad, in his Minchas Chinuch, it's the Kometz HaMincha part of the Minchas Chinuch, discusses this. I'm, in the interest of time, I'm only reading the English parts of the sources, but I brought you the Hebrew for those who have the Hebrew ability, because I always believe it's better to see it in the original. But he says, it appears that if one who has capacity, right, ladat in the Hebrew, if one who has capacity attempts suicide, and someone could save him, he may not be under the prohibition, meaning the prohibition of you shall not stand by. Certainly, he's not under the commandment of you shall restore him, the commandment of restoring to a person his health, which includes restoring health. But a commandment of restoring lost property doesn't apply to property which a person with capacity destroys. And he quotes you the reference in Shulchan Aruch. In other words, if somebody walks out of his house and takes a diamond ring and drops it down the sewer drain, I have no mitzvah of going into the sewer in order to get the ring. If a person is walking and it falls out of his pocket, then I have a mitzvah of trying to help him get back his lost property. But if he throws it away, I have no mitzvah of restoring it to him. He puts his trash out at the curb, and there's something valuable in it, and it's clear that this wasn't a mistake. I have no mitzvah of fish it out of the trash and go explain to him why it's valuable. So Minchas Chinuch says the same thing is true when it comes to health. You have no mitzvah of give this person back his life. He is not even instructed in this prohibition of not standing by, says the Menchas Chinuch. He quotes you a Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin asks, why is it that I have multiple commandments to heal? The Gemara asks, I have a commandment to heal that we just mentioned of restoring one's health to him. I have a separate prohibition of do not stand by while somebody's blood is shed. The Gemara asks, why do I need that? Why do I need that prohibition? I already have a mitzvah of restoring someone's health to him. And when the Gemara discusses this and asks why you need multiple mitzvot, it doesn't say, well, because you need this one of don't stand by for the person who tried to commit suicide. Lest I think that you're not obligated in that case because you don't have to restore his health to him, there's still this other mitzvah. The Gemara doesn't say that. You follow? Let me make sure I said that clearly. We have a mitzvah of restore someone's health to him. We have a prohibition of don't stand by. Clearly, the mitzvah of restoring one's health doesn't extend to the case in which he tried to eliminate it himself. That we know. The mitzvah of restoring his health, that doesn't apply because you don't have to restore someone's property if he tried to destroy it. You don't have to restore his health if he tried to destroy it. The Gemara, though, asks, why do I need a second commandment, the prohibition of do not stand by? And the Gemara doesn't say, Well, because that one will apply even to a person attempting to commit suicide. The Gemara doesn't say that. So says the Minchas Chinuch, Rav Yosef Babad, that means that in fact you have no such obligation. There is no obligation to save his life. Now, there are those who argue about his read of the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And in general, the majority view disagrees with Rabbi Babad. The majority view disagrees with the Minchas Chinuch. They follow the ruling, the apparent ruling, of the Maharam Meirutenberg, right? Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg in source number 9. He's dealing with the case of somebody who indeed refuses to save their life and whether I have any obligation to help. And he writes, since we force people when it comes to spending to feed themselves, meaning somebody who says, I don't want to spend on food, I want communal funds, I want the community to support me, I'm not going to spend my own money. The rule is, in fact, that we do. So we will spend in order to make sure this person has food. Even though that is not so dangerous, but only a matter of physical suffering and a life of pain, because eventually he's going to eat. That's the assumption. Certainly we would do it. Certainly we would also spend. We would get involved to get him out of the hands of idolaters, lest he mix in among them, lest they kill him or torture him endlessly. In other words, if somebody were taken captive, we would ransom him. Even if he said, I'm not going to ransom myself, I have the means, I don't want to do it, we would ransom him as well. And even regarding one who sells his burial plot, the family comes and buries him against the will of the buyer, against the will of the person who bought the plot, and then we'll just have to refund the money. In other words, if somebody sells his burial plot to somebody else, we will buy back the burial plot on his behalf in order to bury him. And even if the person to whom he sold it isn't interested in reversing the sale, nonetheless, we will do it. We look out for people who have made bad decisions regarding their life. And the same thing is applied in this circumstance by many authorities. If you take a look at source number 10, you get a very interesting case. Interesting from a whole range of perspectives that we're not going to discuss. Dealing with writing an amulet on Shabbos. Right? The Gemara talks about using an amulet to save somebody's life. The idea that you could actually write certain things on a parchment, and the person wears it, and that's actually going to save them. And the Gemara talks about how to test and make sure that this actually works. You see if three people with the same type of an ailment tried this amulet and lived, and if they did, that shows this is an amulet that works. The testing method makes a lot of sense. Whether I understand how an amulet will work is another story. But it was taken very seriously. And the question is, could you summon someone to write an amulet on Shabbos to save a person's life? And in discussing this, the Chidah, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in source number 10, gives the following story. He says, several times a young or bitter person drank fatal poison when upset, right? Either a na'ar or a mar nefesh. Somebody who is apt to make these very quick decisions, and they drink this poison, and he, this fellow who's under discussion, wrote this amulet and was successful, causing him to vomit and become healthy. It was some kind of an emetic. It was somehow an amulet which would cause people to throw up. Don't ask me how it worked. I couldn't possibly imagine. Unless you swallow the amulet. Maybe that's what's going on. Sorry?
It was so ugly.
It was so ugly. I don't know. It was a doctor's handwriting on the amulet, and they got nauseous trying to read it. I don't know. So one Friday night, a Jewish girl drank poison and began to die. I mean, she drank it intentionally. She tried to take her life. And they came to this man on Friday night, and he rose and wrote an amulet for the girl, and she immediately vomited and was restored. So the question they discuss in this responsum is the question of writing an amulet on Shabbos. But in terms of the question of overriding Shabbos to save the life of someone who tried to commit suicide, that's not even a debate. They're good with that. Not only do we say, I have a mitzvah of saving somebody's life, but even on Shabbos. That's the point of this. Now, you could argue that in this case, maybe it's somebody who didn't have capacity, but the fact that he preceded it with people who were of bitter spirit, maybe you're talking about somebody who didn't do this while of sound mind. Maybe the argument could be brought. But the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg brings this as halacha. I didn't bring it to you on the sheet, but if you want to look it up, it's Chelek Yud Zayin, Tshuva Beis. he says you have to do everything possible to help this person. Now, all the things I'm saying, because I know this has to be on the minds of at least some people here, all of the things that I'm saying do not necessarily apply if you're talking about somebody who has reached the stage where halachically they're able to say, I don't want treatment further. The idea of compelling somebody to be treated has a gvul, has a limit to it. I'm not dealing with the end of life situations in which that may be justified. What I am trying to say is that that from a medical perspective, do I have an obligation to heal somebody who tried to take his own life? The answer is, you have a minority view, the Minchas Chinuch's view that says, no, you have no further obligation. The majority view, though, is that indeed you are still obligated to treat. We still have to discuss the question of, yeah, but he tried to take other people's lives. That we still have to get to when we get to the judicial perspective. And that's coming up next. But the basic principle seems to be that the doctor may have a mitzvah of healing, even though this person tried to take his own life. Right. So as we said, the mitzvah of healing will apply to non-Jews as well. Rachamav kol ma'asav will apply to everybody. Yeah, he's not a ger toshav. He's not keeping the seven Noahide laws, so that part he's not entitled to. Yes. So again, we have to get to that. That's not under the doctor's perspective. We're dealing. I'm trying to silo each issue for the sake of clarity. You are 100% right that we have this issue, like the Rodev discussion of what about self-defense. So that's actually, conveniently enough, our next silo in the journey. And that is the question of what if you're a judge. You're dealing with things now not from a medical perspective of a duty to heal. You are now dealing with chosh and mishpah. You're dealing with laws between parties. And in this case, this fellow, at least until a moment ago, was a rodev. He was trying to kill people. And not only that, if you were able to snap your fingers and restore him to health, you know what he would do? Potentially go back and do it all over again. We know the rates of returning to this sort of thing when they have the cases in which the terrorist goes to jail, and then a couple of years later they kidnap an Israeli, and you release 1,000 of them, and we know how many of them go back to doing this again, right? Despite the fact that they sign a paper that says they're never going to do it again. Yeah. I'm glad I'm not on camera for that. So how do we look at it from the perspective of this person being somebody who is trying to kill us, has tried to kill us, and certainly doesn't seem to regret that aspect of it? So we have a precedent for viewing enmity as permanent, such that we will say that even though his act of redifa, his act of pursuit has ended right now, we view him as an enemy in an ongoing way. That's not new. There's a classic Tosfot in source number 11, which I'm going to explain outside of the sheet, but you can see it there. It goes back to Parshas Beshalach. Parshas Beshalach begins with the Jews having fled Egypt, and the Egyptians find out, Paro finds out, and he goes racing after them with chariots. Right? Vayikach sheish meyoshet rechav bachur, shlosh meyos rechav bachur? 300 to 600. He comes back to them with hundreds of chariots. Chariots presumably are pulled by
horses.
We know that. The Torah tells us that they're pulled by horses. Where did Paro get horses? They don't have horses. Don't you remember they had a plague of Shchin earlier? Right? You have the boils on the animals. You had Dever, which struck with a cattle. And then after that, you had the Barad, you had the hail. And the hail destroyed everything that was outside. So where does he get horses from? He has indoor horses. Why were the horses indoors? Says the Torah, Hayarei, Dvar Hashem, the people who believed what Moshe was saying, the good guys, right, who were in fear of the impact of these plagues, they heard Moshe say that there's going to be a plague of hail, and they said, you know, it would be a good time to bring the horses inside. Those people who believed Moshe are the ones who end up using their horses to go race after the Jews to try to catch the Jews. Says the Medrash in Maseches Sofrim, which Tosfos quotes in source number 11, that tells you Kasher Shebiknanim, in some editions Mitzrim, Harog, that even the best among them, it's Sheshmeos, it's there in the source, in number 11, it's 600. That tells you that these people, even the good ones among them, are going to come after you. If you are at a time of war, he says, don't show any mercy because it's just going to come back to bite you. That's the message here. Now, you could give all sorts of other explanations for those horses. You could say that the people who actually brought them inside weren't good people. They just knew that Moshe had a track record, right, of plagues coming true, and therefore they brought them inside. These weren't necessarily kosher people. You could also say that Paro commandeered them. You don't have to assume that these people gave their horses willingly. When Paro says, give me your horse, the answer is not no. So you come up with other explanations for how it is that these horses end up pursuing the Jews, but Tosus's point, quoting this Maseches Sofrim, is to say, these people who, even the best of them, but these people who are the enemy, never stop being the enemy. Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, makes the same comment. I brought it for you in source number 12. And he says, this is a reference to the story with Amalek and the city of Tziklag. You're familiar with the Haftarah that we read on the Shabbos before Purim, right? The Haftarah of Zachor, in which Shaul goes to war against Amalek, right? And he wipes out all except for one man, Agag. A few chapters later, in the Navi, actually I don't know if this is what Ralbag is referring to. Ralbag may be in a different context. But a few chapters later in the Navi, Amalek comes along and they attack and burn the city of Tziklag. They take all the women and children captive. They destroy the city. Ralbag says, when you have the enemy in your hands, don't think that you're going to rehabilitate them. Get rid of the enemy now. That's his statement. And it comes up in Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, regarding a moser, in source number 13. A moser, in its simplest sense, is a Jew who wants to curry favor with powerful people, and he does it by turning over Jews to them, giving their property over to them, or even turning them over to die. And I'm not dealing with questions of authority and reporting people. That's not, on the most basic level, Moser has nothing to do with government and a Jew who committed a crime. It's just simply somebody who renders Jews vulnerable to people who will attack them. And the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says that once this Moser has done his deed, you're not allowed to kill him in order to save people in the future. Because once he's done it, it's done. LMK and Huchzak Limsor, unless he is established in this practice, unless this is what he does all the time. If this is his ongoing practice, then he's just going to kill other people. And therefore, you are supposed to stop him by whatever means you have. Right? This is brought up in halachic discussions regarding sexual abusers in particular. Recognizing that the fact that he did this in the past doesn't mean he isn't going to do it in the future. We look at patterns of behavior, and we look at which types of behavior get repeated, and on that basis, we are required to act. And so the argument here regarding this terrorist would be, if you heal him, it's going to come back to hurt you, right? Sheldon told me about a case that was in the Israeli media about a surgeon. I don't want to get it wrong, but roughly speaking, a surgeon who reattached the fingers of a bomber, and who said, he said that you could see the powder on his fingers. It wasn't a bomber; it was somebody who was a bomb maker. And then the surgeon himself ended up being, was it wounded or killed?
Wounded
in an attack with a bomb later on. A bomb from this bomb maker? Do they know? They don't know. But you could end up healing somebody who comes back to attack later on. The big question in this regard of the Rodeif, the Bala Hargachash Kem Lahargo, the question of self-defense, the big question on the other hand is, you don't know for sure. You don't know for sure that he's going to go back. And that leads to the question that we call in Halacha, Safek Rodeif. What if I don't know for sure that this person is going to do this? Am I entitled to let him die because I think that he might do it? Yes?
You know that it's known for sure that some 40% of them return to the job. In fact, if they know 40, there's probably 70 or more. And they get paid for it.
Right.
Possibly there's a specific incentive for them to return to the job.
Right. And clearly he thought it was worthwhile the first time. So Dr. Nussbaum points out, I don't know the numbers, but sounds like reasonable numbers to me, that 40% of them return to it, and the number, if we know of 40%, may be much higher than 40%. So let me ask you the question. Let's say you know that it's 70%, but you're going to let 10 out of 10 die. Right? So that means that, based on your own statistics, you're going to let 3 people who wouldn't have done it again die. Now, maybe they deserve it because of what they already did. We have to talk about that. But in terms of suffix rodif, when you're not sure, you're making a very heavy decision. Yes?
Well, 2 things. First of all, this all assumption so far is that we know for sure that this is individual.
Correct. So again, this goes back to my point about Dr. Elbaz in the beginning, and the separate question of you don't actually know for sure that you have the right person.
And
yeah.
And what about the Yishmael when the Malachim said to Kadosh Baruch Hu, why, you know what he's going to do in the future? Why don't you take his? Why do you let save his life now?
Right, but you know the answer from that same source, right?
Yeah, judgment.
No, the answer against that from the same source. He brings this story, it's true, Rabbi Berman brings the story of Yishmael, right? Yishmael is cast out of the house. He is this poor 17-year-old kid who is starving and exhausted in the wilderness, and Hashem sends him a well. Right, he cries out, and Hashem sends him a source of water, and that way he's able to survive. As the Psukim say, his mother cries out, but as the Medrash says, he cries out. And the Medrash says that the Malachim, the angels, cry out to God and say, don't you know what his kids are going to do to your kids? Which the Medrash didn't even know the half of. The Medrash is written a couple of thousand years ago. But they say, don't you know what his kids are going to do to your kids? Why are you saving his life? And the answer, based on the verse there, is as he is now. He hasn't done it yet. His kids haven't done it yet. However, this is not a person who we know nothing about. The Medrash begins by Hashem saying to the Malachim, what is he right now, Tzaddik or Rasha? And the Malachim say, he cried out to you, he's Tzaddik. Can't say the same thing for the bomber. Right? He has a track record of already harming us. And as far as we can tell, the only God he's cried out to was to say, you know, Allahu Akbar before blowing everybody up. This is not, this isn't Yishmael under the bush in the wilderness. This is fundamentally, this issue of whether you can kill somebody who is a suffek rodef, who might attack, is actually a very old debate. Its most modern version, aside from this case we're talking about now, is in the terrorist exchanges. And the question of whether you trade, you know, your 1,094 terrorists for the body of a soldier who was killed. So the question becomes, do you view them as people who are going to go right back to it, and therefore you can't do that? Do you say, well, maybe they won't? And it's actually a debate, this issue of suffek rodef. Some say that you can't kill somebody on the doubt that maybe they would come after you. You can't do it. Now, note there may be a difference between killing somebody and failing to heal them. I'm not equating the two. But when you're dealing with a rodef, and you have the debate of whether to attack this person, this potential pursuer, some say you have to actually be sure. Rav Moshe Feinstein made this point in source number 14, the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English at the top of the next. He's dealing with an abortion case. A case in which there is a fetus, and the fetus is endangering the life of the mother. And so the question is, the fetus is technically a rodef. It is a pursuer. So the question is, will you take the life of the fetus? And he writes, killing a fetus is prohibited until the doctors have great reason, close to certainty, that the mother will die. Meaning die without killing the fetus. Since the permission is due to the fetus's status as a pursuer, it must be near certain that he is, in fact, a pursuer. You have to really know. Rav Asher Weiss makes the same point in source number 15. Now, you could argue that the fetus case isn't a good analogy, right? Why is the fetus not a good analogy? He's not guilty of anything. He's not conscious. Maybe I have a higher threshold of certainty when it comes to ending the life of somebody who doesn't even know what they're doing. On the other hand, maybe it's a lower threshold because it's a fetus. And in halakha, we do not equate a fetus with somebody who is already out of the womb. Their life is not the same. So you could actually make the argument both ways. Stan?
So are you comparing the fetus to the rotev? He doesn't know what he's doing, but he has a complete machshava that he knows what he's doing. His intention is to kill. The fetus is a physical body that's causing a problem.
Right. So the answer is that in halakha, we do equate the fetus with a rotev. However, it may be that there are grounds to be to err on the side of caution with the fetus because the fetus doesn't know it's doing anything. There is no conscious intent, as you're pointing out. I didn't intentionally not translate Rav Asher Weiss in number 15. That was just because I put the source sheet together in Hebrew before translating it and somehow skipped that one. Maybe I'll get a chance later and I'll send out a new one with the translation on it. But Rav Asher Weiss takes the same stance regarding not a fetus case, but the case of an actual rodef, somebody who is indeed pursuing, and he distinguishes between the law of Baba Machteres and the law of rodef. Baba Machteres means a person who breaks and enters. And the rule in the Torah is, Ein lo damin. If somebody breaks and enters to somebody's house, the person invades the homeowner is entitled to take his life, even though he doesn't know for sure what would happen if the burglar would see him standing there. Meaning, it could be that the burglar would turn around and flee. Or it could be the burglar would shoot. Right? I think in different societies, at different times in history, the answer to the question of what would the burglar do has changed. It could be, certainly in more violent areas, that the burglar is more likely to do it. Rav Asher Weiss points out that the Torah says the burglar has no blood, literally, meaning that you take the homeowner defends himself at the expense of the life of the burglar, unless he knows for sure that the burglar wouldn't kill. That seems to be the stance of the Gemara. There's some indications that are otherwise, but that's a basic read. So Rav Asher Weiss says, when it comes to the invader, the home invader, you don't need to be sure. When it comes to a rodev, though, it's a different law. They're not the same law. The person who is coming to attack, you need to be sure in order to take his life. I'm not talking about now where it's your life versus his. Let me actually take a moment to make that clear. Meaning, if he's coming after somebody, and it looks like he wants to kill, the victim, potential victim, is allowed to save his own life by whatever means necessary. If he can, shoot him in the legs, fine. If you can't shoot him in the legs and you're worried that your own life is going to be forfeit, then you defend yourself. However, if you're short of that situation, and you don't know whether this person actually would kill, Rav Asher Weiss's stance is, you don't use lethal force. Others disagree and say, absolutely not. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, absolutely not. He equates the case of the home invader with the case of rodef in source number 16, and he says, because he was asked about this in the context of Jews and non-Jews, that's why the word Jewish appears in the source. He says, the fact that one may rise up against a Jewish invader on a weekday as opposed to Shabbos, that's its own discussion in his source, but the fact that one may rise up against a Jewish invader on a weekday and kill him, and we don't say to let the invader take his money, is because killing a pursuer is entirely permitted, even where his intentions are only uncertain. Anyone who tunnels in, a person who breaks into the home, is not definitely a pursuer. You don't know that he would kill. Nonetheless, you're allowed to take his life. So Shlomo Zalman says, Rodef and Baba Machteres, the home invader and the pursuer, are the same case. And you do not need to be sure. The same position is taken by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau in source number 17 in Yachel Yisrael. All of these that I noted on the sheet are contemporary writers dealing with this issue on a very practical level. And and their position is that even if you're not sure, even if you're not certain, you have to have some degree of certainty, but even without 100% certainty, you're justified in viewing him as a rodef. Now, there's an added dimension to this. In this under the heading of judge, we've discussed this in terms of him being a rodef, and we've seen that since he has already done it, there is an argument to say he would do it again, and therefore I should view him as a rodef, even right now. And there's an argument to say, no, you need to be 100% sure, with serious voices on either side of this debate. There's an added debate, though, which is, do we ever save murderers? Let's say he's not pursuing me. Let's say he would never do it again. Bottom line is, assuming that I know that this is the guy, he just killed people. Right? If there were a Beit Din, if there were a rabbinical court that was authorized to carry out capital punishment, if you had proper witnesses, he would get the death penalty. Why are you saving his life? That's a question in its own right, even if he's not a Rodev. Let's say I know 100% he's never doing this again. Let's say as part of the accident he blew off his hands and he blew off his legs and now there's nothing he can do to carry out any attacks like this ever again. The only question is, do I save his life at this stage? Let him live out his life in this way. The question is, fundamentally, he's killed people and therefore maybe he should not deserve medical care. That's his own question. And Rav Shlomo Kluger dealt with this question in source number 18. Not exactly this scenario. It was a woman who poisoned her husband and was herself poisoned. She killed the husband, but she herself is poisoned. In number 18, I was asked by a rabbi, he says, regarding his sister-in-law, Yamach Shema, he writes, who killed her husband with poison. Would she deserve for him to save her? That's his question. I come upon the scene. She is still suffering from the effects of the poison, but I could make her throw up and save her life. Do I save her or do I say she just killed her husband? And I answer, this is the explicit passage in Nida 61. What he's talking about is the Gemara there involving either Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Tarfon. As I understand it, if I remember correctly, there are two different versions of it. But the story goes this way. Person comes to Rabbi Tarfon's house, bangs on the door. Who is it? Let me in, I am being pursued by the government for having killed somebody. They claim I killed somebody. Let me in and hide me. And Rabbi Tarfon's answer is, well, you know, I can't believe Lashon Hara when they're saying that you killed. On the other hand, I have to protect myself as well. You're not coming in. That's Rabbi Tarfon's response. The commentators to that Gemara debate what was going on. Was it where Rabbi Tarfon thought they were actually guilty? They were murderers? Or was it where he was going just based on the rumor that's around, and whether, you know, does he have to endanger himself by protecting somebody who they want to kill? So as it's read here, as Rabbi Kluger reads that Gemara, it's where he actually believes they are murderers. They're guilty of committing murder. And so he says, the sages said regarding harmful speech, this Lashon Hara, the word that they're killed somebody, one should be concerned, etc. Rashi there explained, I am not allowed to save you, was what Rabbi Tarfon was saying. You committed murder, I'm not allowed to save you. Rashi must believe that one is definitely prohibited from saving her in the case of the former sister-in-law. And even according to Tosfot there, who says it's not so clear that they committed the murder, one could say that their stance was only where they were not known to have killed. That the Tosa's position is different because he says it's where we don't know for sure that they committed murder, and then you would be required to save them. But where it is certain that they killed, Tosa would agree not to save them. In other words, it's a little bit of a complex source, and I'm not going to be able to go through the entire issue. But the argument that he's making, that Rabbi Kluger makes, is that in the event that you believe they committed murder, you don't save their lives. You don't do it. There's no obligation to save their lives at all. The Sefer Hasidim said this as well. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, in the time of the Rambam, but he was in Ashkenaz, took this stance as well. In source number 19, he quotes you a pasuk in Mishlei, a verse in Mishlei, in Proverbs. A man who oppresses the blood of a life will flee to the pit. No one will support him. And on that he says, if a murderer flees to you, do not accept him. Jew or non-Jew, doesn't make a difference. If he's a murderer, you don't protect him. So what emerges from this, and by the way, Rav Zilberstein says this, he brings this as halacha in Shirei Torah L'Rofim. It seems to me that whereas with the doctor, there's room to say the medical obligation to treat persists, even if you're talking about the case of somebody who himself tried to kill and was hurt trying to kill, the judge's perspective is absolutely not. The judge's perspective will be, he is a rodef. Maybe you could argue, according to those who say suffake rodef should not be killed, maybe they will say otherwise, but I think the general perspective is that the enmity that he displays is permanent, plus the fact that he already tried to kill people, and therefore he doesn't merit that you save him, and not to mention, I haven't really emphasized it, but go back to the IMA statement, the Israel Medical Association statement. They're talking about treating him first. So that potential victims will actually, they could die while you are trying to resuscitate the alleged terrorist. Yeah?
Are you talking about a murder-suicide?
In that case, the poison case?
Yeah.
So it appears. Not necessarily, but it could be. We don't have enough detail to know for sure whether it was intentional that she poisoned herself.
Okay, so if it's a murder-suicide...
Could be she just drank the wrong cup, you know.
Yeah. Okay, maybe if it's a murder-suicide.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Then you have the other question of trying to save somebody who tried to end their own life. Sharon.
Okay, I have two questions.
Yeah.
One, sometimes there are limited resources.
Yep.
And you have one packet of something, and you've got two people... the alleged bomber or
whatever
and,
it is.
Yeah. And this victim beside you. Which one do you, are you obliged? And they both look fairly equally sick. Do you take your own first?
So assuming you believe that your obligation to heal applies to both of them. If you take the doctor's perspective that even this person who tried to take his own life is going to need to, you're still obligated to heal him, then you make the argument that you follow the laws of triage, and whichever one of the laws of triage dictate is the one you're going to take first. I should note, though, that again, when you make your decision, you're not making it only as a doctor. You are making it also as a judge, and you deal with this other issue of, does he deserve anything such that I should, not save somebody else in order to save him? We're not done yet. We have three more perspectives to see. The latter three are shorter than the first two. But let's see what happens once we've seen the collective perspective.
Okay, and the second question I have
is,
what if the killer, your bomber, says, he's conscious and he says, I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
He actually says he's going to do it again. Does that change the perspective?
I think it makes you less in doubt. So under the Safek Rodev, he is no longer a Safek Rodev. Now he is just a Rodev. He has dropped his first name. And I think that on that basis, the judge will say no. He has no entitlement to your care whatsoever. If anything, just the opposite. Maybe you should, physician-assisted death. I don't know. Maybe he needs some help. He has expressed a desire to end his own life. The third perspective is the military perspective. What is it that a pure soldier would say? So the simple approach would be to say, the soldier would say, let him die, it's a deterrent. If they know they can do this and we're going to get them back to health again, that gives them more of an incentive to do it again. So I just wanted to note for you, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel said it's not so clear cut in source number 20. He says, in Islam, the commandment to redeem blood is a great commandment. One need not add fuel to the fire. His first concern is that in the event that this guy dies, now all of his relatives are going to attack as well. That's number one. But number two, he says, killing them will not necessarily deter, because the executed person becomes a martyr, right? Now he's a shaheed. One must weigh this well with security experts. He says, it could be that actually this isn't a deterrent. In other words, they go into this wanting to die. Letting him die doesn't necessarily mean that the next one won't do this. They actually want to be dead. So maybe by saving his life, by failing to save his life, you're not actually creating a deterrent. But one argument is, let him die, and maybe it'll deter people from doing this sort of thing. Further argument is that this is war. We have no obligation to save soldiers who are on the other side. They chose to go to war with us. If you take a look at source number 21, Rabbi Dov Lior writes, an attacking terrorist comes in the name of his nation. His goal is to strike any Jew in any way. And therefore, this is considered not a criminal act, but a war against the Jewish nation. In other words, lest you say, well, it's not a war. There's no battlefield. It's just a criminal act of trying to stab people or blow up a bus. He says, absolutely not. What defines the difference, he argues, between a criminal act and an act of war is if he's just trying to attack indiscriminately. If he's just trying to kill Jews, that's war. It's a war against the Jewish people. It's not a particular attempt to harm a particular individual. Yes? Jack?
The UN Convention is an obligation to provide
So we're going to come back to the Geneva Convention. We're getting there. The Geneva Convention, you're right, Dr. Sandler points out, what about the Geneva Convention about helping the or providing medical treatment to prisoners of war? We're going to come back to that question in a little bit under the politician perspective. So hang on, it's a good point. The Maharal, in source number 22, regarding Shimon and Levi, right, and their attack on the city of Shechem, says the following. He says, we do have a mitzvah of when you go to war against the city, v'karasa eleha l'shalom, you shall call to it for peace. But he says that's where they have not acted against Israel. Where they have acted against Israel, such as here, the case of Shechem, where they had broken forth doing this repellent thing, the rape of Dinah, then even though only one of them had done it, since they had attacked first, Israel was permitted to respond. And he says, so too for all wars, even where only one of them had acted, he is part of the nation. Since they attacked first, we were permitted to go to war against them. And that's the statement of the Maharal. He believes that there is a that it's a war, and therefore we're not under any obligation to take care of their soldiers. And Rabbi Avram Shapira, writing in an article in Truman, it was actually a response to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. We'll see Rav Aaron's position shortly. But he says, we need to protect our own soldiers. He says, where there is no substantive risk to our soldiers, there's no permission to strike lives or property. However, when there is a discernible risk, one must remember, it's not only a matter of weighing one unit opposite a civilian population on the scale. He's dealing with collateral damage questions. And the question of one unit in the military versus civilians on the other side, he says the loss of one unit or part of it can affect the entire battle. We lose our soldiers, even if they're trying to do a noble thing and save people on the other side, that could actually turn the tide in the battle. That's his argument. However, there are two points to remember on the other side. All of these points seem to be militating towards saying, no pun intended, militating towards saying that I have no obligation to save somebody who is fighting against us in a war. I am a soldier. From a soldier's perspective, this guy tried to fight against us, and he's not entitled to my care. He's not entitled to my concern. However, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in source number 24, notes that it's not so simple and straightforward. He, again, he's dealing in context with a collateral damage discussion, the issue of civilian populations. But he says the price of war is also paid by the enemy, who is also graced with a divine image. And one should grieve whenever God's creations drown in the sea. On this point, the issue of quantity is meaningful. How many people will be hurt on either side by this decision? And one certainly must weigh the justifications for harming many in order to save an individual. He's not so comfortable with the idea of saying, well, they're the enemy, let them look after themselves. He says you have to consider your impact on the other side. Now, keep in mind, he's dealing with a civilian population. He's not necessarily dealing with an attacker. So that has to be kept in mind when you look at this. But the other point that you have to keep in mind is Rav Yaakov Ariel, which I'm going to say outside, but it's source number 25. And I'm indebted to Rabbi Baruch Weintraub for pointing this out to me. He says, war has to be run by a central authority. You can't have a position in which everybody makes decisions for themselves. Right? It's the most Jewish of armies, in which everyone's going to make a decision for themselves and say, yeah, I know that's the policy, but, you know, dot, dot, dot. But he says, that's not a way to run a war. You need to have policies, and you need to have higher-ups, and there has to be a level of responsibility to the system as a whole. And on that basis, you would say, it's not for the person on the scene to decide, I'm going to treat or I'm not going to treat. You follow what your instructions are. However, he also notes that can't be entirely true. Because sometimes, even the lowest-level soldier has to make a call, has to make a decision on the scene, and hope that they're right. He points out that in the war that the Jews fight in Shoftim, in Judges, against Canaan, a woman by the name of Yael decides to kill the enemy general Sisera. She didn't phone up the higher command that asked, what should I do with him? Right? She just did it, and it was the right decision. So he points out there's a tension here. The more you empower people to make the decision unilaterally, the greater your risk of anarchy in your military setting. So even as I think the tendency is from a military perspective to say, don't treat, to say, do not take care of him, to say that the maybe it's a deterrent and this is war and he's an enemy combatant and so forth, there has to be some level of caution on this front. So we've seen three perspectives now. We've seen the medical perspective, which seems to slide towards treating, although the Ben Chaschinuch is on the other side. We've seen the judicial perspective that says not to treat. He is a Rodeif. And again, the minority possible view that says, well, you don't know for sure that he would go back to it, but you still have the point that he is a fundamentally a murderer. And then you have the soldier's perspective, which I think is more towards the side also of not treating. But on the other hand, you have these other perspectives of not taking life lightly, like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein pointed out, and the point of war needing a central authority, and the fact that dying isn't necessarily a deterrent for them. You know, in all of these, the issue is very complex, clearly. Let's go to the fourth level. The fourth level is the politician. What's the politician going to say? Well, on the one hand, the politician ought to say, as I called him on the sheet, the prime minister, right? On the one hand, he should say, going back to Sharon's point before, we have limited resources, and we have a whole bunch of injured people on the battlefield, right? I'm going to now go after treating this apparent terrorist when I'm going to leave other people to die. That's no good. Our triage rules try to give precedence to those who are most valuable to society. I brought you a couple of sources on it. One from Chaim David Halevi and Aseh L'Charav in source number 26. He was dealing with the issue of prisoner exchanges from the perspective of saying, as he did, that the society makes a deal, has a compact of sorts with its soldiers. It says that we are not going to let you get stuck. The soldiers have to be able to go into battle knowing that the nation is going to do everything in its power to retrieve them and will not abandon them. Now, again, I'm not taking a stand now on prisoner exchanges. That's its own discussion. But the main point is society owes a debt to certain people and has to make a commitment to them to take care of them. Rabbi Shaul Yisraeli makes the same point in source number 27, also dealing with this issue of ransoming captives. Well, if so, doesn't our civilian population deserve the commitment of the government that it's going to take care of them as opposed to taking care of the terrorist? The person who knows that he could be the victim of an attack should know that the government is going to take care of him and channel its resources towards his protection. And that's one argument. Now, Dr. Sandler pointed out, we are obligated to fulfill international agreements. Right? The Gemara in Ksuvos talks about this. I brought it in number 28. When Yehoshua honored his agreement with the Givonim, even though they had cheated him, and came to their defense against those who attacked them, because a deal is a deal. You give your word, you're bound by your word. However, it's worth noting two things. Number one, that doesn't apply if they break their oath. Meaning, I'm pretty sure the Geneva Convention doesn't allow terrorist attacks on civilian populations. I'm not sure, I didn't read it word for word, but I'm fairly sure that that's not within the spirit of international agreements. So I think that's one point that has to be recognized, and especially when the terrorists often receive support from the government itself. It's not that there's some lone wolf attacker, but they're going to be taken care of, their family is taken care of. And that's one point which is emphasized in source number 29, the Gemara in Sota, about a treaty that was made between the Jews and the Plishtim, the Philistines, and how Shimshon Samson was entitled to attack them because they had broken their oath by attacking us first. That's number one. Number two is an article that I brought you in source number 30 from Middle East Quarterly. Now, I have to acknowledge that the writer of this article has a certain bias, and you have to know that when you read anything. But take a look at his point. He says, but to what extent do the laws of armed conflict really apply in the war against terror? The answer resides primarily in the text of the 1949 Third Geneva Convention, intended to ensure humane treatment for captured legal combatants. He says, treaties are more like commercial contracts, in that they are traditionally viewed as binding only among their parties. The Third Geneva Convention explicitly states that parties need not apply it to all conflicts, especially when the foes are not parties, and when enemies do not abide by its terms. No terrorist group is a party to the Geneva Conventions. They have not signed, much less ratified, these treaties. Right? When Hamas decides that they're going to sign the Third Geneva Convention, you know, then maybe you have something to talk about. But until then, they're not necessarily entitled to its protections. So the politician might look at this and say, yeah, there is such a thing as a Geneva Convention. We even signed it. but it doesn't apply to the terrorist in front of me, and I have a duty to my civilian population to use my resources on their behalf. In response to this, on the other side, you have two considerations. One, in a case of tragic irony, is Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. Yes, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who a year ago from this past Sukkot, lost his son, his daughter-in-law, in a terrorist attack, had said that maybe one ought to treat them because of a concern for Chilul Hashem, source number 31. He says, in truth, there's a desecration of God's name even with actions that are legal and even during war. And he goes back to the case of the Givonim who made their treaty with the Jews and cheated them in order to make the treaty. And the Gemara itself says, as he notes here in number 31, that the oath was not truly binding. Our treaty was not binding. But still we didn't attack them. Because of the sanctity of God's name, he's concerned for Chilul Hashem. He's concerned for what the nations will say. And that's one point. And then the second point is the concern for Eva, for enmity. Enmity is a halachic factor, meaning that there are things that we are able to do that we don't do because it will cause other people to hate us and potentially to attack us. There's a very dramatic example brought by Rav Zilberstein in Shirei Torah L'Rofim in source number 32. I'm not going to read it outside, but basically he comes up with a story which I would love to confirm historically about something that happened, he says, in the end of the Ottoman Empire, that there actually was the possibility for Jews to reclaim the Temple Mount. And as he records it here, they went to the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, at the namesake of the Rav Rav Soloveitchik now was named for him, and he said that you can't do it. He said I could deal with all the halakhic problems. It wasn't that it was that we would have access to the Temple Mount to bring the Korban Pesach. That was it. And so, and he said, I could deal with all the halachic issues surrounding bringing the Korban Pesach nowadays, needing to be pure, needing the right kohanim, and all that. I could deal with all of that. However, as quoted here, he says, I can't find permission for the shedding of the blood of a single Jew by the Muslims because of the Korban Pesach. They're not going to be happy when we try to bring sacrifices on the Temple Mount, he said. And on that basis, he says, don't bring the Korban Pesach. So the argument goes, they're going to attack us. In the event that we will not treat the terrorist, it's going to rebound on us because they will attack us for it. Now, number one, they're not necessarily our friends anyway. Meaning all the people who are going to attack us now would attack us regardless, even if we treat the terrorists. That's one argument in response. Another argument in response is that the halakha calculation of Eva is not so simple. Meaning, Eva, fear of enmity, as it would be translated, is only a justification, potentially, for doing certain things and not others. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in source number 33, dealt with this. And he distinguished between two kinds of enmity. He says, if enmity would cause the nations to act against us, it would cause people who are not Jewish to act against us, then you're right. He said, that justifies even violating biblical law. If an action would cause people to act to actively attack us, then yeah, violate biblical law rather than trigger that. We're saving lives. However, if it's less than that, it just means they won't be so happy with us. They may not like us. Then he says it doesn't warrant violating a biblical prohibition, which you may be by taking care of this person who is a terrorist and letting somebody else die. So it's not simple and clear-cut. The stance of the politician is significantly complicated. The argument can be made both ways. On the one end, you could say the debt is to the population first. They're the ones we have to worry about first. And the international agreements do not protect the terrorist. But on the other hand, the argument can be made that there's a desecration of God's name and it will inspire more attacks on us if we don't treat him. And again, coming back the other way, really? They're attacking us anyway. It's not as though this is really going to change the calculus overall. I want to jump to the last topic. I know there may be questions on that, but we have 7 minutes. The last topic is the humanitarian. The humanitarian, meaning we already said that a doctor may be obligated to heal, but aside from obligation, there is the aspect of the Jew that wants to heal. Meaning just, it's the way we are trained, it's the way we are brought up, we are educated to be, hopefully, people who want to look after others. The Gemara in Yevamos is well known in source number 34, in which we are told that the hallmarks of the Jew, the three hallmarks of the Jew are Rachmanim, Baishanim, and Gomli Chasadim. We are supposed to be merciful, we are supposed to be bashful, modest, and we are also supposed to be people who are generous. This is supposed to be the identifying factor of the Jew, such that King David actually, in number 34, in the greater passage there in the Talmud, King David is in a position to accept or not accept certain people into the Jewish people. And he says, if they're not merciful, they can't possibly be Jewish. If you take a look at source number 35, Rabbi David Stav, in a contemporary context, deals with this question. He's dealing with the issue of eliminating a terrorist who apparently has been subdued. And he says, these days, when the boiling blood is mixed with civilian willingness and resourcefulness, it's important to maintain our moral superiority, to avoid harming a person who is not involved in murderous activity, and to avoid harming those who have already been neutralized and no longer pose a danger. He was writing this before the Elor Azariah case ever happened. It was in the beginning of the knife attacks in Israel. He says, it's not because they're innocent. They deserve to die. But that is not our way. Harming a terrorist who has been neutralized causes double damage. The collateral damage is when these images are distributed. The main damage is harming our moral norms. We will not stoop down to our enemy's despicable behavior. We will not contaminate ourselves with a moral breakdown. And Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, the similar idea that you see in number 36, that's the part of the same essay that I quoted earlier, the statement that it does harm to us when we engage in this sort of action. So you look at it and say, well, if the Jew is supposed to be merciful, then he should treat. Except, you go back to Sharon's point before, which is, I'm using limited resources to take care of the terrorist. What about the other people? That's number one. Number two, correct. You're technically not acting, you're just failing to act, and maybe that's less bad than acting explicitly. And then the last point, you always have to remember, here it appears in Radak, or Yedavid Kimchi, it appears in other sources as well, which is, Hachemla al Rishayim Achzariyut, mercy on the wicked is cruelty. Because you know that they're going to wage war on us in the end, meaning it's all well and good for you to be a merciful person today. What are you going to tell this person's victims tomorrow? And that's another consideration. So someone who's on the scene, or somebody who's developing policy, does not have the luxury of saying, I'm going to approach it as a doctor, or I'm going to approach it as a judge, or I'm going to approach it as a humanitarian, or any of these perspectives. The policymakers, or the person on the scene, have to actually take all of these into perspective at once, which is why I go back to the point that Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg made in the beginning, which is you need a crystal clear policy for implementation, because no human being on the scene is actually going to really go through all of these different elements in order to figure out whether to do CPR or not. You need to have a policy for people to carry out. I will not state a conclusion. Because really, how in the world can somebody sitting here, right, in Toronto, make a conclusion about something that's a very live issue for people on a day-to-day basis in Israel? I think it would be beyond hubris for someone who doesn't have to pay the price in either direction to try to state something. But I think what we've seen, I hope what we've seen, and afterwards I'll stick around for questions and conversation if people want to discuss it further. But I think what we have seen is, in terms of the doctor's obligation to heal, more heavily on the side of saying that the doctor may have a mitzvah of healing in this case, even though this person has tried to end his own life. From military perspective, from a judicial perspective, more on the side of saying not to treat, because he is a rodef, because he is a murderer. From a military perspective, I'm inclined to say, based on the sources that I've seen, it's more on the side of saying don't treat him. Don't save him. He's an enemy combatant. And even though you'll say an act of terror is a criminal act, because it's indiscriminate, that makes it more of a military act, especially when it's also government supported. The politician's perspective I give up on, it's hopeless. Because the politicians can and do argue both ways based on what we've seen. And while the humanitarian position is appealing to say, well, we want to be merciful, and this is our trade, and this is how we're raised, and this is what the Torah conveys, at the same time, misapplied mercy is cruelty. And I think Radak is 100% right, that you can't be merciful in the extreme and just use that as your doctrine, because you will end up working against the causes that you're actually trying to support. Thank you very much. There is a lot to say, and I will stick around, but because we advertise it as 8:45 to 10, I don't want to hold people beyond. So if anyone has questions or something to discuss, please come up. I expect to send out a follow-up email later with a link to the audio recording, so please make sure that you signed in. Also, especially if you want CME credits, make sure that you signed in. Thank you very much.